This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome. Good to be back after a few weeks of travel and some repeat programs. We have a lot to catch you up on as we review the recent important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And David Vigil.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hi.
We are going to start with political news from Britain and America. An explosive situation in the U.S. has developed quite suddenly, with Democrats pushing to impeach President Donald Trump. We'll talk about that second. But first, we will talk about Brexit. The October 31st deadline for Britain to leave the European Union is only 6 days away. Britain is still at an impasse. Prime Minister Boris Johnson is trying to break the deadlock, but opposition is fierce. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard.
Yes, that tells you just about all you need to know, really. The deadline is 6 days away, and we still have no idea what on earth is going to happen when that deadline hits. And to kind of give the story so far over the last week or two, about this time last week or a little before, Prime Minister Boris Johnson appeared to pull a rabbit from his hat. He and the EU surprisingly agreed on a deal, even after kind of everybody had written this off as impossible. The deal was better than the deal that Ms. May had agreed, I think in some very tangible ways. At the same time, it had some pretty big imperfections. But it looked like he had a viable deal, a deal that was going to be... Yeah, that the kind of the hardline Brexiteers would still just about get behind it, and at the same time, all of the Remainers in Parliament that really want Britain to stay in the EU, that they would also get behind it as kind of something that would stave off a no deal Brexit and still keep Britain close enough to the EU to their liking. So it kind of looked like he'd done it, and that now he was going to be able to bring Britain out of the European Union on October 31st with a deal. Then last weekend hit, and very quickly that you began to see a strategy from the pro-EU people in Parliament. They spent the last few months talking about how essential it is for Britain to have a deal, how saying things like, well, we don't oppose Brexit itself, we oppose a no-deal Brexit. Now, if they immediately came out against this deal, it would kind of expose all that as a bunch of lies and show that actually they were just against Brexit all along and were looking for any excuse to prolong things. So they couldn't come out against the deal right away. Instead, they chipped away at it from the sideline. They tried to attack it in kind of complicated ways. So rather than vote against the deal, they put forward an amendment that effectively killed it and then voted for that. So that came through on Saturday. The government fought back with a way to kind of get around it at the start of the next week, and what they needed to do that was they needed Parliament's approval to fast track this deal through so that it would be approved by the end of this week and Britain would be all set to leave on the 31st of October. The government did not get the approval to put that deal on the fast track, and so then they declared it dead. You know, they said, well, what's the point in having a deal if we're not going to be able to leave on October 31st? If it's going to take us months to implement it, we've already had 3 years to talk about this. Let's not prolong things. We're not going to push this deal anymore. So in just over a week, this deal has kind of come from nowhere to surprising everyone to going back to nowhere again. And the latest news is that the government is going to push for a general election. The vote for that will be held on Monday. And people are talking about December 12th as the date for that. So they're trying to go back to the people. And I think Boris Johnson wants to say, look, we tried our hardest to get Britain out of the European Union on October 31st. We were frustrated because of pro-EU people in Parliament. You know, you voted for Brexit. Please kick those people out of Parliament. Send us back with a majority and we'll get Britain out as soon as we can.
So if this is put to the people, and it looks like this is what is going to happen, that there's really no other options on the table at this point, what may happen there? Is that where Boris Johnson actually does gain a little more leverage to be able to do what he feels needs to be done?
Well, I mean, you're right. It is. It does seem like the only way forward at this point. But I don't think fresh elections are a foregone conclusion.
Mm.
David Cameron and a few governments back passed the Fixed Term Parliament Act, which was a piece of constitutional vandalism that kind of... And now it's causing a big mess into how the whole system works. Under that, it's the government needs the approval of Parliament to call fresh elections. And... You know, the Labour Party are doing badly in the polls. Just about everybody who's not in the Conservative Party are doing badly in the polls. Even some in the Conservative Party are kind of worried about the risk. You know, it's always a bit of a dice roll. So there may not be fresh elections. The vote will be on Monday. The Labour Party saying we won't vote for fresh elections until the European Union has confirmed that they're extending for at least Britain's EU membership for at least 3 months. Meanwhile, France is saying we won't extend Britain's EU membership until we see how the vote goes on Monday. So even the idea of fresh elections is up in the air. And if they don't vote for fresh elections, then we're starting to get in weird territory. Then people are talking about the government just going on strike and refusing to do anything until Parliament grants fresh elections, because it can't do anything.
Yeah.
But you know, some in Labour have said, well, we're not going to approve fresh elections until a no-deal Brexit is an impossibility. You know, basically, we don't like it. We don't think that should even be an option for people to vote for.
Mm.
We're not going to allow fresh elections until that happens. So, that's up in the air. And then as to who would win, I think it's a tough one, because we're in kind of uncharted political territory here with the Brexit Party gaining significant support of the vote. I think if you look at a lot
drawing votes away from the Conservatives, is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so if that vote gets split, then maybe you could see the Conservatives doing badly. Now, I think there are a lot of polls that show that the public in general approve of Boris Johnson's strategy, and that would seem to imply that he would do well in the elections. At the same time, though, you have got a man who literally calls himself a communist and, you know, will go and wave the hammer and sickle, etc., leading the Labour Party, and who does want to bring communism to the UK as the leader of the main opposition party. So if it doesn't go Boris Johnson's way, the stakes are pretty high.
Yeah.
It's almost like out of the EU or into the Soviet Republic, the United Soviet Republic of England.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's quite extraordinary to see just how many battles Boris Johnson is having to face. It's like everywhere he turns, he's bumping up against just implacable opposition. And it seems not only within his country with the pro-EU side of the Remainers within Britain, but of course, Europe is in no great hurry to provide him any sort of help either. He's got a certain segment of the British public, and that's just about it. But the way that everyone is playing their cards, they're denying him just about any route forward.
Exactly. I mean, we talk on the show a fair bit about the parallels between the US and the UK, but I think the fundamental thing here is you do have an elite in kind of both countries that think they know better than the general population. And so you have this situation in the UK where that elite, you know, offered the election, said it's going to be a one-time thing, said we'll implement what you vote for, and then almost immediately turned around saying we don't like that vote, and started working to frustrate this. Now, they had an election 9 months after the Brexit referendum, and all those people stood on platform saying, you know, vote for me. I promised to implement the result of the referendum. I didn't personally agree with it. I didn't vote for it, but we're a democratic country. We've got to respect the vote. And there's so many videos of these different leaders saying that. And it's been proven now that it was all lies.
Mm-hmm.
They are now turning around and it's still this, we know better. You know, the people can't decide. And you see that in America. Well, the people may have voted for Donald Trump, but he's got to be impeached because we know better. We know that's not the way that you do government.
Mm-hmm.
We, from our exalted perch, have a much higher vision than everybody else and know how things should be done.
Right. And it's worth mentioning that it's not just the fact that they are elite, but that they are elite and very leftist that's creating the big problem. I mean, the idea that, say, if we just put everything to the people, that somehow all of these things would work out, is not necessarily the solution to all of these problems, but in this case, it's the fact that you have these people who are positioning themselves to make these decisions in lieu of the people who are so much further left than the people themselves are, that makes it quite significant. So it's definitely something that our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, has talked a lot about, just how dangerous it is that these individuals are gaining so much political power within these countries, that's creating problems that really are it's remarkable to see just how much power they have gained and control within these nations.
Absolutely. I mean, that's it's a bit ironic, but in some ways the best material to go to understand what's happening in the UK is our books America Under Attack and Great Again. And if you were to kind of judge those books by their covers or by their titles, you might say, you know, they're books about American politics. But fundamentally, they're not. You know, they're books about the spiritual reality that is impacting politics today. Mm-hmm. And you know, they do focus on the impact this is having on America, this, you know, major superpower. And that's where the focus of the books are. But that spiritual reality absolutely impacts Britain. And it's why you have this same trend in both countries. And that book goes through, you know, specific prophecies. You know, the Bible talks a lot about a spirit world. You know, even Jesus Christ talked about Satan and demons and a spirit world that impacts world events right now. And those books really go through and expose how the politics that we see, and again, they focus on the United States, but it's the same story in Britain, you know, how that spirit world is having a very real impact on the situation that both nations find themselves in.
Well, thank you for that, Richard. That definitely leads right into our next story in America and the aggressive moves by Democrats in the House of Representatives to impeach President Trump. For this story, we'll turn to David Vigil.
Yes, so it's been about 1 month since the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi launched an impeachment inquiry into, the presidency of Mr. Trump. It started basically with a probe to find out whether or not he abused his presidential powers in seeking help from a foreign government, Ukraine, to undermine his Democratic opponent, presidential candidate Joe Biden, and help in his own reelection. So that started about a month ago. And ever since then, President Trump has been essentially saying that it's an attack on his presidency and the process has been unfair. You just recently had Republican Senator Lindsey Graham introduce a resolution condemning the process of saying it was a closed door, illegitimate impeachment inquiry. And so you do have some Republicans agreeing with President Trump. And basically what they would like to do is bring the whole formal inquiry into an open debate in the House where everyone can see the evidence, figure out exactly what they're trying to impeach President Trump for, and then vote on whether they should even start that inquiry. So, right now, it's basically been an inquiry where the you have about six committees investigating right now, and it's been behind closed doors. We don't really know exactly what they're investigating, what exactly they're going to impeach or try to impeach President Trump for. It's not been a clear process, even because I don't know if you remember, but Jerry Nadler in the House Judiciary Committee, he claimed he had already been starting the impeachment inquiry months before. And so basically, President Trump says the whole process has been unfair. He hasn't had a chance to defend himself, doesn't know exactly what they're trying to charge him with. And some of the senators are agreeing. They just want it aired out with an open debate where it's very clear what they're trying to do with President Trump and where they can present evidence and then President Trump can defend himself. So that's kind of where we're at in the whole process. It's been a battle back and forth, obviously. But one of the things that has been damaging to President Trump's defense so far is that there looks like there could be some former staffers that will testify against him. So there have been a lot of people in his administration who have been fired. There was Bolton. Well, he actually resigned before he was fired, but there's Rex Tillerson and James Mattis. And those men were, I think, very embarrassed by the process of their firing or the situation, especially Mattis. He was fired on Twitter. They're not senators. They're not representatives. They're not going into elections. So they don't have as much attachment to, say, Republican Party success as the senators or the representatives in Congress that are Republicans. So they are, I think, more fueled to just potentially take President Trump down than bolster the party. So the Democrats are very excited about that. They're hoping to get some big dirt on President Trump and push forward on that procedure in the impeachment process. But it's been, I think, a very political battle where we're not really clear exactly how the Democrats are going to go through this process of impeachment and exactly what they're going to impeach him on. I think what it is clear right now so far is that there are not enough votes in the Senate to remove President Trump. So a lot of it, I think, right now is just a battle of image and trying to see how much they can embarrass President Trump and hurt his reelection chances in the future more than even removing him from the office.
It's amazing to watch this unfolding. Obviously, the Democrats have been looking for some way to take down Donald Trump since even before he took office. And now they think they have it. And it just seems like they're wolves on the hunt now, that they sense that they really may have an opportunity to do serious political damage.
Yes. The issue that Nancy Pelosi has decided to draw a line in the sand, I think, is one that a lot of Americans probably wouldn't even care about, Ukraine investigation. It's pretty clear that a lot of people and presidents in the past have asked foreign governments to do certain things. I guess they're trying to tie it to the election process, but I don't think there's been any evidence presented showing that he was asking for a favor to destroy a political opponent. He was just trying to get to the bottom of Joe Biden's son's involvement and his company's involvement in Ukraine over there. So it is an interesting issue that they decided to come after President Trump, and you can just see that they're just so eager just to find anything to take him down.
But it is it does seem like that even many say conservatives who have been very critical of Donald Trump are very they seem to be weighing in closer to the Democrats' position on this issue. And like you said, it comes down to there's probably enough of a wall of senators, Republican senators, who will not approve his being impeached. So it seems like you have two sides that are just getting more deeply entrenched in their position, that the acrimony and bitterness between these two sides is becoming worse and worse, and this all as we're preparing to enter into another election cycle here over this next 18 months.
Yes, you can see that bitterness too, because even how Nancy Pelosi has gone about in this process of impeachment, the inquiry has broken precedent with what was done with President Clinton and Nixon. So the Constitution doesn't outline specifically what the process should be, but because there have been impeachment inquiries, you have precedent set. And so that's what Senator Graham has been arguing for, is just let's get a whole House debate and figure out if we want to start an inquiry as a whole House rather than just kind of these committees dominated by political enemies that, of course, are going to want to take them down. And so you just see that division, like you were saying, and it points exactly to what Mr. Fleury's been writing. And he's got that in the booklets, America Under Attack and Great Again, about the division in Israel, modern-day Israel, which America is part of it, and just tying it back to the spirit world, Revelation 12, verse 12, and where we have a deadly adversary who is working really hard to destroy America. And well, he wrote in Great Again, Revelation 12, verse 12 reveals that Satan is our deadly adversary. He's the one behind these dangerous developments. The devil is full of wrath, and he has gotten control of the radical left. The fruits prove it, and these people want to bring the system down, end quote. So you just see this, the system, they're just attacking the system. They're trying to bring it down, and we just have this open division. It's just embarrassing, I think, not just for President Trump, but for United States in the whole world, just to see what's going on here. And I think too, for much of the world, if they were to look at the issue that Pelosi's inquiring about, would probably just laugh at the idea of impeaching a president for talking to a government about investigating some corruption.
Well, nothing, just looking at it from a prophetic standpoint, nothing that we've seen to this point indicates anything but that Trump will remain in power. But the animosity just continues to increase. We're going to talk later in the program, at the end of the program, about how more Americans are believing that a civil war may be in the offing. But yeah, it's hard to see how it could get any worse than it is. And yet, as this unfolds, and once the inquiry actually reaches conclusions, and you start having votes, and you start having pressure put on senators to declare, are they for or against? And even those who are for, I think they're being pushed into positions that they probably wouldn't, they'd rather not have to. Mm-hmm. But if you look at just how those who are trying to take him out, what would happen if one of these Democratic presidential candidates were to actually take office? The kinds of policies that they're proposing, and the just how radically it would move the country even further to the left. I think there are a whole lot of people who feel like they're really stuck between two very unsavory options, and really like nation threatening type options. Mm-hmm. Either way,
it's exactly what Richard was talking about with Britain over there with Jeremy Corbyn.
Right. Yeah.
You have exactly the option, right, of being in the EU where they don't want to be, or face a communist administration. And it's really the same thing over here, where the elite, the political elite and the media elite, are radical left, and they're trying to basically undermine the whole democratic process and remove the decision made by the people through the voting process.
We will put links to America Under Attack and Great Again in the show notes for today's program, and you can find them under the literature tab at thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much for that, David. A wave of popular protests is hitting several countries across the world right now. Perhaps one of the more surprising is in Lebanon. To tell us about this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
These protests have been going on for just over a week now, and they involve massive amounts of Lebanese citizens. Over 1 million Lebanese have come out and protested against government corruption, taxes, and just the economic situation that Lebanon is in. Lebanon is I think the most indebted country, or close to it, and so you've got people taking to the streets, upset with their government, and this is to the tune of 25% of their population, which, if this protest was happening in the United States, that would be at 82 million people, just to give everyone a sample size of what this looks like. And what's been interesting about this is the unsectarian nature of the protesters. This means that Lebanon is divided up into all these different groups of different branches of Islam, Christians, and secular, and yet they're all there together protesting against the government. And what has been surprising is that there have been many Shiites come out and protest against the government. And of course, the leader of the government right now, or the party that holds the most seats and the control over the government and over these policy decisions that could alleviate some of the stress on the economic situation, is of course Hezbollah. And so you have had, even in the strongholds of Hezbollah in Beirut, Tyre in the south, you've had massive protests come out, and Hezbollah isn't escaping the wrath of the Lebanese.
So why is it so surprising that these protesters are singling out Hezbollah?
Well, I think what the part of the issue is that Hezbollah, of course, as I said, does lead the government. So there's that factor. It's also that they're amongst the ranks of Hezbollah soldiers and families that come out of the Shiite section of society, about 25% of the population of Lebanon. Those people are getting increasingly upset with their political party because of the Syrian civil war, the involvement of their sons over there. And now back home, they see Hezbollah as being the leading political party that is the main cause for the situation that they're facing. And so this is big, because you don't come out and rebel against Hezbollah in Lebanon unless you might have a death wish. And there have been plenty of politicians, plenty of individuals that have been assassinated and killed for such actions against Hezbollah. You've had some of these protests, they actually had burning effigies of senior Hezbollah officials at these rallies. This is the first time since Hezbollah was formed that the Shiites, it seems, are turning against it. So since the 1980s, haven't had mass protest of Shiites against Hezbollah, and now we're seeing it for the first time.
So this is another arena where it seems like Iran's foothold is being threatened, is it not?
For sure. I mean, this has got to be very worrying for Iran. We see the mass protests taking place in Iraq right now as well. They haven't died down, and that is one of the main, you know, reasons for that is they're protesting against Iranian interference in their country. And what we're seeing in Lebanon here is very similar to that, except there's more people protesting. And what it hopefully sees, or what hopefully means for a lot of Lebanese, is that maybe Hezbollah isn't as strong over the Lebanese state as people anticipated. There have been some violent parts of these protests, not on the part of the general population, but pro-Hezbollah people have had counter demonstrations and gone amongst this. And as soon as you start fighting against a peaceful protest in Lebanon, and Hezbollah is doing that, that's not going to look good for them and their rule. They are sustained by popular vote. That's why they are leading the government. And so it looks like the favor that Hezbollah has received from the Lebanese public is going downhill fast. Now, in terms of Bible prophecy, we are looking for Iran's hold over Lebanon to fall out, to no longer, for Iran to no longer hold power over Lebanon as they do now. It doesn't seem that Hezbollah would be ever able to come out from the umbrella of Iranian patronage and Iranian leadership. Hezbollah is going to answer to Iran, but you have a large portion of the Shiite population now in Lebanon that is becoming anti-Hezbollah. And so this is very significant. It's something that the United States has been pushing for. It's something that many commentators have been asking the Shiites in Lebanon to stand up against Nasrallah and Hezbollah, and maybe we're seeing the starting of that right now. That prophecy is found in Psalm chapter 83, and it discusses how that Lebanon or ancient Gebal is going to side with a different alliance than Iran, the Psalm 83 alliance. It's actually going to be alongside Europe. And so maybe these popular protests are going to further along that prophecy that starts to remove Lebanon from Iran's grip.
Where would you send people to learn more about that, Brent?
Our editor-in-chief wrote an article, Mr. Gerald Flory wrote an article about this a couple of years ago, and that article is entitled, Why You Need to Watch Lebanon.
Okay, we'll put a link to that in our show notes. We appreciate that very much, Brent. Iran has been active in recent months in attacking oil infrastructure and transport in the Middle East. Japan announced its plans to safeguard its investments there, and those plans are quite telling and significant. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this story really begins back in June when two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman were attacked by limpet mines. One was a Norwegian-flagged vessel, and the other one was Japanese. We spoke about that attack on Trumpet Hour at the time. And as you said, after studying the evidence, world powers in Europe and the U.S. agreed that Iran was responsible for carrying those attacks out. So the U.S. from there started to work toward building a coalition of nations to monitor and accompany and protect any merchant vessels that were sailing through that region. There's a hefty percentage of the world's natural gas and oil that passes through there. So the goal was just to prevent any future disruptions. And several nations joined the coalition, Australia and Britain and Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, the UAE. They all joined it. They committed soldiers and aircraft and ships to it. And the U.S. expected Japan to join it as well. Japan is America's closest Asian ally. One of the two ships that Iran attacked was also Japanese, as I mentioned. So the expectation was that Japan would join that U.S.-led coalition. But the trouble, from Japan's point of view, is that Japan has no oil. Japan is actually usually described as having virtually no natural resources. So their economy is totally dependent on imports. And when it comes to crude oil, about 80% of all Japan's imports come from the Middle East. And one way the Japanese try to ensure that that Middle Eastern oil keeps on flowing into their economy is by maintaining friendly ties with Iran. And so, you know, the Japanese know how powerful Iran is becoming, and they really bend over backward to do their best to avoid placing any kind of undue strain on their ties with the Iranians. And since this U.S.-led coalition is really seen as mostly an anti-Iran entity, the Japanese decided not to join it. Instead, they've opted to go it alone. They're sending their own warships, their own aircraft into the Middle East to safeguard any Japanese merchant ships there. And they're doing their best not to portray it as being directed against any particular nation.
So this is actually part of a trend that we've seen for quite some time with Japan using incidents like this. And it's really, I guess you could look at them as somewhat of a pretext for a remilitarization on a fairly broad scale within Japan.
That's right, yes. In recent years, we've seen Japan's so-called self-defense force grow by many orders of magnitude. Officially, this is branded as being strictly for self-defense, and that's just because of the fanaticism that, Japan displayed, not just in World War II, but in many chapters of history. The Japanese have shown a tendency toward really aberrant fervor and military fanaticism. So after they were defeated at the end of World War II, the U.S. and other allied powers really enforced pacifism upon the nation. And they said, your military is strictly for self-defense. But over the decades, the SDF, the so-called self-defense force, has become a fully integrated, ultra-modern ensemble of land, sea, and air forces that could really rival those of any other country. And then in more recent years, we've even seen the Japanese reinterpret the pacifist clause in their constitution to allow them to deploy forces overseas if it's to help an ally that's under attack. We've also seen the last 5 years massive defense budget increases and several other steps. So this decision to deploy to the Middle East there is only the latest step in Japan's sort of stealthy, quiet return to open militarism. And for another country, that might not be that worrying. But when you consider Japan's military history, this really should be sounding alarm bells worldwide.
And I guess the other aspect of that story is just the fact that this is such a strong move by Japan, showing that the alliance between Japan and the United States isn't what it used to be.
That's true. Yes, this definitely puts the declining influence of the United States on display. To have one of their closest allies opt out of this coalition and decide to just go it alone. So it showcases that, and it showcases just how militarily powerful Japan has become.
Well, Jeremiah wrote an article about this that went out as a Trumpet brief yesterday. That article is on thetrumpet.com right now. The title, Japan Will Send Its Own Force to the Middle East and Won't Join U.S. Coalition. You can read that there. And also, we have a trend, Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's March Toward Militarism. That trend article, part of a whole set of articles on thetrumpet.com that shows the big picture of the big trends that we are watching. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes for today's program as well. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. I'd like to encourage you to visit our literature library at thetrumpet.com. We feature a few free books and booklets right now. At the top of that page is the new booklet by our editor-in-chief, The Book of Hebrews, What Jesus Christ is Doing Today. It's a marvelous booklet, and it shows just how this biblical book of Hebrews is extremely relevant for our time today. There are a lot of proofs showing that it was actually inspired by God mainly for this end time, just before the second coming of Jesus Christ. So go check that out, and there are a few other featured items there right now, including Child Rearing with Vision, Winston S. Churchill, The Watchman, Does God Exist?, How God Values Music, and some others. And from there, you can access our entire literature library if you're interested. Check out the literature tab at thetrumpet.com. You'll find a lot of outstanding material there. Coming up, we're going to talk about the latest events in Syria. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
U.S. President Donald Trump announced a decision to withdraw American troops from Syria, and Turkey promptly moved in to fill the void by launching a military operation against Kurdish forces there on October 9th. This development has many other nations scrambling to respond. Perhaps the most significant of these, from a prophetic standpoint, is Germany. For this story, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
So the plan with the ceasefire that is currently holding in northern Syria after the United States said it was going to leave was to create these a safe zone right along the border between Turkey and Syria, inside Syrian territory, basically where the Kurds were. And that's kind of the territory that Turkey is trying to push the Kurds out of, and that Russia came up to try and stop the Turkish advance from going too far. And so there is this ceasefire idea that includes these safe zones, which would mean that some of the refugees that are inside Turkey could come back to Syria. They could live in this safe zone for a while. It also has caught the eye of the German government in the sense that the German defense minister, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, she's called now for not just this security zone to be set up, but she has said publicly that it's not enough that Russia and Turkey are the ones that guarantee the safety in this area. It needs to be an international force. And she is proposing, coming forward to propose that Germany be part of this force inside this safe zone. Now, this is the first a time that Berlin has proposed a new Middle East mission by itself. So for that point, it's significant. Whether this comes to fruition or not, that we could debate about that. But it is interesting that the eyes of Berlin, at least one of their leaders, now is looking towards the Middle East and trying to insert Germany into that arena. Now, right now, Germany has a temporary seat on the United Nations Security Council, which will give them the ability to float this idea with the Security Council coming very up shortly. And it looks like the United States is partly supportive of this announcement. And although she might have some pushback in the different parties inside the government in Germany, there are other German politicians that are willing to see that Germany needs to be active here.
Yeah. So Richard wrote about this in his in an article on his Trumpet Brief earlier this week, and it was quite remarkable. Richard, you quoted this article by Gerald Fleury, "How the Syrian Crisis Will End," and he went straight to the prophecies showing how Germany's influence in Syria is going to play a major role in what happens in this country ultimately. As you said, Brent, the whether or not this particular deployment occurs remains to be seen. But it is quite something to watch this in light of those prophecies and that statement from our editor-in-chief.
This is something very specific that we've been watching for, and it seems very unlikely as well that Germany would be inserting itself into the Middle East. And so when Mr. Fleury came out and wrote that based on Bible prophecy, we've had plenty of naysayers looking at this saying it'll never happen. And here is Germany proposing its first mission in the Middle East, and it happens to be in Syria. Now, this looks like it is there at least is going to be negotiated. The foreign minister right now is meeting with Putin, discussing this very thing. Tomorrow he flies to Turkey to meet with Turkey about this very thing. And so they're at least going to look into whether it is going to have support of Russia and Turkey inside Syria.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note as well that we've kind of gotten used to Germany doing maybe some of these token deployments. You know, we'll send a couple of dozen people to go train the Kurds or that kind of thing. And they're definitely important to watch, and there are important things behind that. But what they're talking about in Turkey is just on in Syria is just on a completely different scale. You know, I think one German politician was just throwing around numbers in the ballpark, but he was talking about 20,000 troops. Now, they wouldn't all come from Germany. That would be European. But as a ballpark figure, that dwarfs anything that Germany's doing now. I think from memory, they might have a couple of thousand in Kosovo, Mali several hundred. But they're looking at taking the lead in a very significant military mission doing this. And then I think that
your article actually said 40,000 troops. You're talking about
40,000.
Yeah, 40,000.
Misremembering
From the defense expert in the Bundestag.
Yeah, so it's a huge mission. And then I think there's appetite within Europe for this. You know, given the way that America changed courses very abruptly over this, there's been a lot of people talking in Europe and saying, well, you know, this shows that we need to be doing more. We need to stop relying on America to take care of these problems for us. It shouldn't be American troops in Syria.
Yeah.
If we want the job done, we need to do it ourselves. It should be European troops there.
Yeah, just the way that this has unfolded, it plays well into the hand of the anti-Trump European contingent. Very interesting. I would really recommend that you go and read Richard's article on this. It's called Germany Wants to Invade Syria, and we will definitely keep tabs on how this unfolds. It is a situation in development. Whether or not Germany actually puts this contingent together remains to be seen, and we will keep our eyes on it. Thank you very much for that, Brent. Efforts to denuclearize North Korea have hit a standstill, and a growing number of voices in South Korea are saying it's time to take a different approach to the problem. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the speculation that South Korea could soon develop a nuclear weapons program is growing louder. And the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists published a report about it this week that makes some, I think, some really compelling points. The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists is the same organization that runs the famous Doomsday Clock, which we've spoken about on the show several times. And their new report about South Korea says that there are two major variables that influence South Korea's calculus about whether or not it should begin a nuclear weapons program. One of them is how likely it is or isn't that North Korea would abandon its nuclear weapons. The other one is the guarantee of the U.S.'s extended deterrence in the event of a nuclear crisis happening there on the Korean Peninsula. And right now, both of these factors are trending in the wrong direction. With North Korea, there was real hope that the Trump administration would be able to reach a deal to denuclearize the country in exchange for lifting sanctions on it. But those talks collapsed back in February, and then another round of those talks failed again earlier this month. And meanwhile, the North has resumed tests of some of its nuclear-capable missiles. These are, they're shorter-range missiles, so the U.S. isn't very concerned about them, but they are fully capable of striking anywhere inside of South Korea. So that is deeply worrying for the South. And then with the United States, South Korea is a treaty ally of the U.S., so America would be expected to protect the South if it's attacked, and it would be expected to hopefully deter any attack before it even happened with all of the troops and weaponry that it has stationed there. They've got 28,000 American troops. They have some THAAD missile defense systems. But since very early in his presidency, Mr. Trump has talked about how displeased he is with this burden-sharing arrangement with South Korea, and just about how the South should be paying more, how the U.S. should bring the troops home. So, you know, as of yet, we've not seen any of that talk translate into meaningful action, but it has rattled many in South Korea. So the combination of these two trends, North Korea's unwillingness to denuclearize and the doubtful eye that South Korea casts on the United States, has South Korea more and more interested in developing its own nuclear weapons. And the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists says, quote, "If these trends continue, a nuclear South Korea is a question of when, not if."
So just from a prophetic standpoint, how do you see this playing out?
Well, it's hard to say whether or not South Korea would actually develop a weapons program. But from a prophetic standpoint, we know that a nuclear war is on the horizon. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has recently written a really powerful booklet called Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. And this book takes a deep dive into the Bible's prophecies about the third and final world war. He shows in that booklet that World War III will be fought with nuclear weapons. There's an abundance of evidence in the scriptures that show that it'll be a conflict so devastating that it could threaten to wipe out all human life. So that's really possible only with all-out nuclear warfare. And this booklet does just a really powerful job, I think, of showing that whether South Korea develops nuclear weapons or not, that conflict is rapidly approaching. And it also shows, though, that there is an almost incomprehensible hope tied into these developments that we're seeing, because the Bible makes clear that that world war will be interrupted before it can wipe out all human life. I don't want to spoil the ending of the booklet for anybody who hasn't read it yet, but this booklet is one that we send out for free, and it's a potentially life-changing read. So for any listeners who don't have a copy of that, I would just strongly encourage them to read it.
That booklet is a featured item at our literature tab right now. Nuclear Armageddon is at the door. We also have an article that we'll put in the show notes. South Korea readies for a future without America. Jeremiah wrote that about a year ago. You can find that at the on the show notes for today's program. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. Germany's Conquest of the Balkans. That's the name of a booklet our editor-in-chief first wrote back in 1999. We've been closely tracking this strategic region in southern Europe ever since. In the latest of these moves, we see fascinating back and forth between Europe and Russia. To learn about this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, so it's important to remember the Balkans right now is kind of this border area between Europe's sphere of influence and Russia's sphere of influence. So it's important to watch because it can it gives you a very good sense of what is going on between these two nations. And over the last couple of weeks, we've seen really what are some pretty big victories for Russia and a refusal by Europe to move any further into the area. So on October 17th, Northern Macedonia, they were scheduled to move to pass the next hurdle and move on to kind of much more formal talks for joining the European Union. North Macedonia, just to remind you, is the new name of the country that was used to be called the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. The big thing holding them back had been trying to agree with Greece on the status of that name. That was sorted out. They were meant to be moving forward. The European Commission, European Parliament promised that they would move forward, and then France vetoed them moving forward with that. This comes after the Netherlands vetoed Albania moving forward to European Union membership. So both of them have been stopped in their tracks and at least for now left out of Europe. And then at the same time, like you said, just today, the Serbian prime minister is over in Russia, and he is signing a free trade deal with basically Russia's version of the European Union. It's called the Eurasian Economic Union. And it was Ukraine being about to sign an agreement with this union that triggered the whole palaver over Ukraine that ended up them getting invaded. Serbia is signing up to that agreement, and there's very little palaver about it. And so what I think is interesting here, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Plurie said it's really critical to watch the relationship between Germany and Russia. There's a whole load of prophecies that talk about Germany becoming a major military power, Germany turning against Britain and America. And to do that, to expand outwards historically, they've always needed a close relationship with Russia, or at least some kind of deal with Russia. And he said that he thinks a deal with Russia has already been done. The events in the Balkans over the last couple of weeks completely support that. Europe's kind of almost voluntarily halting its move into the region. Now, they do have Croatia in there. They've kind of broken up Serbia to the point that it's a rump of what it used to be, and most of its strategic territory is gone. They've kind of, they've got the critical coastline there that's on the GNC, with Croatia being already in the European Union. And they appear to be quite content not to move any further. And instead, Russia is moving into the area with little opposition from Europe. So it definitely supports that analysis from Mr. Flurry there. The best place, I think, to go to learn more about this relationship between Germany and Russia is Mr. Flurry's article, Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America. That really exposes some of the close contacts between these two nations, the way that they're working together already, and how the Bible prophesies that they are going to turn against the United States. And I think what we saw in the Balkans is just kind of like a smaller symptom of this much bigger and critical prophetic story.
All right, thank you for that, Richard. One last story. Is America on the verge of civil war? A whole lot of Americans believe yes, For this, we'll turn to David Vigil.
Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service came out with a poll showing that 67% of Americans believe the nation is nearing civil war. And the survey also demonstrated that everyone in that poll, or the majority of people in that poll, believed it was getting worse. The division in America is getting worse. And it's important poll to bring out because our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, wrote an article, America's Coming Civil War. So he's come out and said that we're going to have a civil war. You see the division in the politics, and you also see the division in the people as well. And the sense that everyone sees it's coming. Now, everyone sees it's coming. I don't think the normal, typical American wants a civil war, and they would want to have some kind of common ground to stand on. But the problem is that common ground has been shrinking in size. In the past, the American common ground is based on biblical morality and biblical principles, but that's been under attack. So there's been less and less for Americans to agree on. And you can see this in just the deepening division in the politics. And this is exactly what Mr. Fleury wrote in his article. He said, many Americans are troubled by the divisions and hatreds being expressed right now, but they need to be a lot more concerned than they are. The problems are going to get worse and worse until people get the message and learn why these disasters are happening. And he goes on to say that this situation exists in America only because of the sins of the nation. Of all Americans, we can no longer ignore what we have reaped by giving ourselves over to sin. End quote. So Mr. Fleury puts the problem right on the people and on sin. I think a lot of the pundits out there would blame the division on social media and partisanship, and basically all those things are just symptoms of the cause. But because America has stepped away from its biblical morality and the principles it was founded and that everyone agreed on, there's just no common ground for people to compromise on anymore.
And Mr. Fleury's statement about there being a civil war coming to the United States is based on very, very strong prophecies in the book of Ezekiel and elsewhere that show just how much internal division is going to split the country and result in violent warfare that is on a scale that's hard for us to even imagine. Anything that you could point people to would give people more context?
Well, I just recommend them going to thetrump.com and searching for that article, America's Coming Civil War. And of course, we recently talked about Great Again and America Under Attack. And this poll here just shows what Mr. Fleury's been writing is coming to pass. And even now, people just have a sense of that.
Thanks very much for that, David. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can email us any thoughts you have on the program today to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, David Vigil, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah Jacques and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Jonathan Swift. One of the best rules in conversation is never to say a thing which any of the company can reasonably wish had been left unsaid. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.